From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Puerto Rico has a crushing debt crisis, and one of the largest owners of that debt, a Boston-based hedge fund.
Debt is supposed to carry with it some form of risk. And what the hedge funds are doing is really trying to mandate through government and through judicial action that they do get repaid. They're trying to eliminate that risk.
Also today, Kayak co-founder Paul English on why he wants to build a new memorial in Boston to Martin Luther King Jr.
I basically feel that the time is really right, given some of the divisiveness in the country right now, the time is really right to do something.
And we'll check in with Bill Littlefield as the Red Sox prepare for another playoff run.
And the Boston Red Sox are once again American League Eastern Division champs.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Puerto Rico no se vende!
Puerto Rico se defiende!
Puerto Rico no se vende!
At Boston's JFK Federal Building today, activists gathered to protest what they see as a lack of federal government support in solving hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico's massive debt problem. The island is carrying more than $72 billion in debt. Otoniel Figueroa Duran, co-founder of the Alliance for Puerto Rico, called on the federal government to forgive Puerto Rico's debt.
We're going to keep the pressure on cancellation of the debt, a Marshall Plan to Puerto Rico. That is the only way Puerto Rico is going to get back on its feet.
Well, last night, speaking on Fox News, President Donald Trump dropped tantalizing hints that he might do exactly that.
Well, we're going to work something out. We have to look at their whole debt structure. You know, they owe a lot of money to your friends on Wall Street, and we're going to have to wipe that out. That's going to have to be, you can say goodbye to that. I don't know if it's Goldman Sachs, but whoever it is, you can wave goodbye to that.
Well, today, White House Budget Chief Mick Mulvaney said the president didn't really mean that and debt forgiveness isn't on the table. But you heard that part where the president said, your friends on Wall Street who own the debt and, quote, whoever they are? Well, it turns out you don't have to go down to New York because one of the largest holders of Puerto Rican debt is right here in Boston. That's according to a new report from The Intercept. Now, that hedge fund is called the Baupost Group. It's a highly successful hedge fund owned by billionaire Seth Klarman. He happens to be one of the biggest New England donors to the GOP, even though he was deeply critical of Donald Trump during last year's presidential race. Reporter David Dayan is with The Intercept. This is his story, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay, so the Baupost Group, how much of Puerto Rico's debt do they hold?
Well, it appears that they own about $911 million in one particular type of debt called COFINA debt, which is a Spanish acronym for just debt that's backed by sales tax on the island. And the $911 million makes Baupost the largest holder of COFINA debt among the bondholders that own it.
Okay, so the largest owner of that particular kind of debt. But just for perspective here, you're talking $911 million of the something like $78 billion overall that Puerto Rico's
got. Yeah, $73 billion to be precise.
73.
Yes, this is a significant number in raw dollars, but not a significant number in terms of the overall Puerto Rican debt.
Okay, so why would any hedge fund want to own Puerto Rican debt?
Well, because they obtained it at a severe discount. The way that this has worked over the last couple of years is as Puerto Rico got into trouble, the price of their debt went way, way down. And a number of distressed investors, I guess on the island they're called vulture funds, scooped up this debt for really pennies on the dollar and are attempting through legal means to get full value for that debt. This is a common strategy that's used all over the world when certain countries or municipalities get into trouble. It was used in Greece. It was used in Argentina. It was used in the city of Detroit. And there's a whole constellation of these hedge funds that specialize in this. Mm-hmm. And they pick up the debt and they try to get paid out in full, and if it works, they make a huge payday.
Wow, so buy it at a fire sale and try to get paid out in full. Now the second half of that, I'm going to come back to you with you in just a moment, but your reporting went into some detail in terms of how Baupost went about hiding its identity as the owner of this debt. So what exactly did they do?
So Baupost used effectively a shell corporation by the name of Decagon Holdings, and they put the debt that they purchased in the name of this subsidiary, and they did not, you know, give any identifying information as to them being the beneficial owner of this debt. They put an address that was based in Boston, but it was not the address of Baupost. And so it became a bit of a mystery when this was disclosed as part of a legal filing regarding the bankruptcy-like process that Puerto Rico is now engaged in. All members of this group of COFINA debt bondholders had to be disclosed, and the disclosure just said Decagon Group. So nobody really knew what that meant, who the Decagon Group was, so we went about trying to figure that out.
Okay, interesting. And was it hard to figure it out?
Yes. So we went down several blind alleys. We finally figured out that the address that was given, 800 Boylston Street, that's the Prudential Tower in Boston. And we went and looked at the directory, figured out who was in that building. One of the entities in that building is a law firm named Ropes and Gray.
Yep.
And they had some association with Baupost. And what's often done is that the group doesn't put their own address on this, because that would be pretty easy to unlock. If they put the name of the law firm that did the actual registration of the company, the subsidiary shell company, then, you know, they can sort of get one layer down in terms of separating themselves from this actual entity. So that's, I guess, what they did. They used Ropes and Gray, used Ropes and Gray's address when they had to deliver an address. And in the end, Baupost disclosed, after we did a little digging, that they, in fact, were Decagon Holdings.
So they told you, they confirmed it directly.
Yeah, they confirmed it
okay.
In the end,
okay.
After we, you know, went to Ropes and Gray and went to their various spokesmen, and finally they just admitted it.
So, David, here's the thing, though. I mean, nothing about buying, a hedge fund buying distressed Puerto Rican bonds is illegal. It's all completely legal. And it's, as you were saying, it's a common practice amongst hedge funds around the world. So why go to these lengths to mask your ownership?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a good question for Seth Klarman, if you could get him on your show.
We've tried many a time in the past.
My suspicion is that it has something to do with reputational risk. My understanding is that there's a significant Puerto Rican community in Boston. We know that what hedge funds and various creditors have been doing in terms of Puerto Rico has really caused a lot of suffering on the island. It's forced them into this very punishing austerity measures, furloughs, cuts in pensions, closure of schools, things like that. That doesn't really sit well with certainly the Puerto Rican people and their allies and advocates in the states. And hedge funds in particular have been targeted sort of for being part of this really devastating situation in Puerto Rico. And so it could be that a hedge fund that's prominent doesn't really want to be associated with this ownership of Puerto Rican debt, because they might be targeted by activists who don't really agree with that style of investment.
Well, and in fact, in your story in The Intercept, it seems as if that is going to happen, right? Because you talk to Puerto Rican anti-debt activists who say, well, now they're going to, what, protest in front of Seth Klarman's house.
Yeah, it looks like it. And that wouldn't be surprising. That's been done before with some other individual hedge fund managers and companies that have been associated with this debt. So I would suspect that, you know, Seth Klarman's going to certainly hear from those advocates who he tried to sort of shy away from by registering this debt purchase under a shell company. Mm.
So, David, I want to explore just a little bit more with you on efforts to get, you know, the repayment on this debt, as Baupost and I guess other debt holders have tried to do in Puerto Rico. Because you were talking about that a second ago, but let's go into it further. I mean, are you saying that Baupost has been behind some of the political decisions or I guess the maneuvering regarding austerity measures in Puerto Rico?
What we know is that these various bondholder groups have been very vocal in terms of wanting to get repaid. What is happening right now on the island is because of a bill passed into law last year called PROMESA, there is a fiscal oversight board that practically governs all of the fiscal operations on the island, and they have put more austerity measures in place. Number one, and number two, they have fashioned this sort of bankruptcy-style process to ultimately do, you know, some sort of solution, sort of a global solution on all of Puerto Rican debt. It's not really hard to draw a line between the suffering of 3.5 million American citizens who live in Puerto Rico and their creditors, whether they are mutual fund investors or hedge funds or what have you. Certainly, those investors have been extremely vocal about wanting to get paid in full.
So, David, here's the thing. You know, it is perhaps politically distasteful that a very wealthy, powerful hedge fund would go to the extent, as you describe Baupost having done, to hide its identity in terms of being one of the owners of Puerto Rican debt. But isn't the deeper problem not the hedge funds at all or the secondary market that they're operating in regarding these distressed bonds, but the fact that Puerto Rico itself issued bonds that they ultimately couldn't back, that they couldn't repay? I mean, I think a lot of people would say the hedge funds aren't doing anything wrong. That's the secondary market that they're in. The problem is Puerto Rico itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to take a step back and look into why Puerto Rico got themselves into this predicament, there are a number of factors, and Wall Street, frankly, plays a pretty big role in that. They were begging Puerto Rico to take on more debt and take on more debt. This debt had very attractive features to investors. It was triple tax exempt from federal, state, and local taxes, one of the only types of debt instruments that has those features. We know that they were put into very predatory, almost payday loan style debt situations for some of these bonds. The reason that Puerto Rico had to take on all this debt was the depression-like decade since 2006, largely brought about by changes in federal law that really disadvantages the citizens on those islands as opposed to citizens in the United States, even though they share the same citizenship. There are any number of reasons we could probably go for another hour about why Puerto Rico got themselves into this mess and who specifically is responsible. I think you could dole out a number of those factors. But the truth is that we are where we are right now. And we have known for some time that this debt is pretty much unpayable. And the hurricane that went through only reemphasizes that. So the position that the hedge funds are in right now, I mean, debt is supposed to carry with it some form of risk. You don't know when you buy these bonds whether or not you're going to be repaid. And what the hedge funds are doing is really trying to mandate through government and through judicial action that they do get repaid. They're trying to eliminate that risk. And the citizens of Puerto Rico have an argument to make that this is a predatory kind of structure, and they shouldn't be forced into it.
Is this the kind of moment, though, where Puerto Rico could, you know, negotiate with Baupost and others to restructure the debt?
That's what's happening right now.
Yeah.
I mean, that is it's not really a negotiation so much as it's a judicial bankruptcy process.
That process, right.
Where the federal judge is determining what can be done in terms of not only weighing the factor of the debt holders, but also the borrowers and what Puerto Rico can bear. And obviously that whole consideration and calculation has been changed by the fact that the island has been practically destroyed by two hurricanes. You know, if I were a holder of Puerto Rican debt right now, the biggest thing I would do is lobby Congress to get massive aid into that island, because without it, there just doesn't seem to be any way that I would ever get repaid.
Right. On that note, David, one last question. I mean, mm-hmm. Seth Klarman would be in a perfect position to do that, right? Because he's already well known as a major donor to the GOP. He's got inroads there.
That's certainly true. And I have reached out to pretty much every known holder of Puerto Rican debt. That's kind of where this story came from, and asked them if they were willing to engage in moratoria, debt relief, and supporting massive aid on the island. And none of them have really stepped to the fore outside of a few personal donations of a couple million dollars to the Red Cross and done anything really dramatic that would have change that would be wide-reaching for the citizens of Puerto Rico. If it was me, that's the first thing I would be doing.
Well, David Dayan is a reporter for The Intercept. You can find a link to his article about the Baupost Group and Puerto Rican debt. It's at our website, radioboston.org. David, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
And we did reach out to the Baupost Group. They declined to comment publicly. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Right now, the city's only memorial to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. resides just outside of the chapel at Boston University. And it's an abstract memorial, 50 doves who soar upwards, inspired by the words of "I Have a Dream." Now, King and Boston have a deep history. In the 1950s, he was a doctoral student at BU, a resident of the South End, and an assistant preacher at the 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. He returned to the city in 1965 to lead a civil rights march through Boston. Now, these are all reasons why Paul English, co-founder of Kayak, wants to create a new, bigger memorial to the civil rights leader. And Paul English joins us. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Also with us is Tanisha Sullivan. She's president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. Tanisha, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to have both of you, I should say. And first of all, let me just start with you, Paul. Just tell us, why is it that you wanted to be the person to spearhead this memorial?
Well, growing up in Boston, MLK was always important to me. We got taught about him in the schools. His words have just always been meaningful to me. I think he was one of the greatest speakers of the last 50 years. And I was visiting the MLK Memorial in San Francisco back in September 3rd. It's probably my 10th time seeing it, but for some reason I was just really moved by it and thought, I want to do something like this in Boston.
Yeah, and especially since Dr. King does have ties and history here at Boston. So Tanisha, what are your thoughts about whether or not the city should have such a memorial?
Well, first, I want to say that I do believe it is important for each of us to take personal responsibility for making this world, country, city, one that we can be proud of. And so, you know, certainly the way that we do it will be different for each of us. And I truly do appreciate the desire that Paul has to contribute. I also hope that the symbol of a statue is also bolstered by action on our part, both individually and collectively. You know, here in the city of Boston, we continue to wrestle with the issue of race, mm-hmm. And specifically the systems and structures that weigh very heavily on Black and brown people here in the city. So it is my hope that any effort to elevate a symbol of MLK's legacy will be undergirded by a collective effort to dismantle the systems of oppression that he really fought so hard against.
So very good point, Tanisha. Let me turn back to Paul on that. You know, any statue, any memorial, it does, in this, especially in this day and age, bear that responsibility of being sort of, I would say, the beginning point of what we hope is further collective action. So how is it that you see, you know, the momentum behind putting a King Memorial in Boston fitting into that?
It is really important that any memorial not just look at the past, but look at the future as well. And I would like to make sure that visitors, whether it's local Boston residents or tourists from out of town, when they come upon this memorial, I want to make sure they're inspired, but they're also challenged a little bit. And they should think about, if Dr. King were alive today, what would he be talking about? And I think that he's not around anymore, and it leaves an obligation and responsibility to the rest of us to see how can we advance the causes that were so important to him and still so important to many of us.
Mm-hmm. You know, it suddenly occurs to me that we have a great opportunity here with this memorial to really spur people not simply to reflection but to action. And Tanisha, I'm thinking, for example, a while ago we talked with Matthew Murphy. He's the head of an architecture group called Mass Design. They designed a major memorial to the victims of lynching in the American South. And it's not just a memorial. It's a place where people are invited to act, you know, to remember their relatives, members of the community. There are interactive means by which to engage with the history. Do you think that's something that an MLK memorial or statue or something in Boston could do?
I think any modern memorial is really important to look at the past. What is it we are memorializing? And then to look about the present, how does this person or people we're honoring, what would they say about today? And then also directionally, what as citizens of the country, what do we need to do to paint a better future for us as it relates to the issues that we're memorializing?
And Tanisha, your thoughts?
So I do believe that these symbols, whether they're statues or memorials, can play a role in spurring people to action. I mean, we're seeing it, perhaps not in the way that we want to, but we're seeing it across the country today, right? But at the same time, I do firmly believe, as we think about new memorials and new statues, that we are very intentional about how we may want them to inspire people to action. You know, 100 years ago, perhaps we weren't thinking about, you know, the impact of a symbol. But I think today, particularly today, our conscience is elevated in that respect, and we know how powerful these symbols can be.
Yeah, I just feel like we're at a time now, for so many reasons, where just another static bronze somewhere in Boston isn't going to cut it. But so, Paul, if I remember correctly, there have been attempts in the past in the city to create a memorial to Dr. King, but they failed in part due to lack of funding. So how do you plan to battle that possibility this time around?
Yeah, I will say there is a pretty nice memorial by the Morris Chapel at Boston University, memorializing his time there, where he got his PhD. But as far as doing something on a larger scale, the most central part of Boston, it has been promised by many years. Mayor Menino talked often about it. Mayor Walsh talked about it early in his tenure. Speaker DeLeo talked about it. I basically feel that the time is really right, given some of the divisiveness in the country right now, the time is really right to do something. I'm putting in a significant amount of money, and I'm also raising money, and I want to do something spectacular for the city.
Well, Paul English, co-founder of Kayak.com and the man who's spearheading an effort to build a new memorial to Martin Luther King in Boston. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna. It's nice to speak with you again.
And Tanisha Sullivan, president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. Great to have you as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are just 5 weeks to go until the mayoral election in Boston, and a new WBUR poll finds that the high cost of housing ranks as the top issue for polled Boston voters. The new WBUR poll also shows that incumbent Mayor Marty Walsh has a commanding lead over his challenger, City Councilor Tito Jackson. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks has this report.
Maybe Jimmy McMillan should run for mayor of Boston. He's the guy who founded the Rent is Too Damn High party in New York and ran unsuccessfully for mayor and governor. McMillan's slogan might well resonate in Boston, where voters put the price of housing on the top of their list of complaints.
The cost of housing is something that affects everyone.
Steve Cazella is the president of the Mass Inc. polling group, which conducted the WBUR poll. He points out that Boston has some of the highest housing costs in the nation.
You see very low rental vacancy rates. You see sky-high rents and houses that sell almost the second they're listed. So it's not hard to understand why the cost of housing is the number one issue.
Hey! How you doing?
Campaigning in Roxbury recently, Tito Jackson says the housing issue is among the top reasons he's running for mayor.
On South Huntington Ave, which is right around the corner from here, it is $2,200 for a studio, $3,200 for a two-bedroom, and $4,200 for a three-bedroom. What family can afford $4,200?
Jackson proposes a number of policies, including abolishing the Boston Planning and Development Agency and expanding the stock of affordable housing. One reason why Maria Cristina Blanco of Jamaica Plain supports her.
I'm really fortunate to live in deed-restricted affordable housing. That changed my life. I think everyone should have that right, and we don't have a high enough percentage of affordable housing.
For his part, Mayor Marty Walsh says he is increasing the affordable housing stock. His administration has sped up the permitting process, and in the last 3 years, more than 13,000 new housing units have been built, many of them for low- and middle-income residents. Here's Mayor Walsh.
We set a record in Boston in 2014, then one in 15, then one in 16, and probably one in 17 of building low-income units. But we also have 30,000 new residents living in the city of Boston. So as quickly as we're building it, people are coming into Boston. So we are building more low-income units than ever before.
Even so, 76% of voters are dissatisfied with housing prices, according to the WBUR poll. Close to the same number of people have big concerns about gun violence in the city, which has seen a spike in shootings this year. Next on the list of complaints are Boston's congested streets, gang activity, overall crime, and the state of race relations in the city. But even with more than half of voters expressing dissatisfaction on all these issues, the poll finds that Mayor Marty Walsh remains very popular, outpolling Tito Jackson 60-24%. Again, pollster Steve Cazella.
A booming economy will paper over a lot of dissatisfaction, and I think that's some of what you see going on here.
Cazella says the poll found that 60% of Boston voters are very satisfied, or somewhat satisfied, with the availability of jobs in the city. So despite some high-profile missteps, like his failed effort to bring the Olympics and IndyCar racing to Boston, Walsh remains very popular, with numbers that rival his predecessor, Tom Menino.
I love Marty Walsh. I've been with him from the very beginning.
This is Cassie Martirana of East Boston. On election night last week, she gave Walsh high marks overall, even though she's unhappy about too much development in her neighborhood.
Too many buildings going up in every nook and cranny. We're way overcrowded, too much congestion. I got the tunnel. I got a guy behind me that just built 9 units, 4 stories high. It's just too much.
But Martirana plans to stick with Walsh. Pollster Steve Cazella says the high number of voters like her represent a big challenge for Tito Jackson, even though the WBUR poll found that he's pretty popular as well.
Tito Jackson, we have 50% viewing him favorably and only 9% unfavorably.
In other words, very few people dislike Tito Jackson. But at this point, they just don't see a reason to replace Marty Walsh.
That story from WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Wednesday, which means it's time for our weekly sports segment with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so it's October, and the Red Sox are back in the postseason, just like last year. They're number three.
I hope not.
No.
Just like last year wasn't so good.
I was going to say, are they going to do better than they did last year?
Well, they can't do
year.
Worse. So that's the positive way to look at it. They can't do any worse.
Okay. Well, this is kind of painful, but let's remind folks to the end of the series last year where the Sox had to bow out.
The roar from the Fenway faithful for Ortiz. Bradley and Pedroia, the runners. Here it comes. Fly ball. Shallow right. Chisenhall. Cleveland wins, and the Indians are headed to the American League Championship Series. They have swept the Boston Red Sox.
So, not exactly the way David Ortiz hoped to bow out.
No,
but,
no.
But do you think, I mean, this year, though, I've been seeing that the Sox have been wearing shirts with the slogan, October ready. So come on. Why not?
Because my experience, and I realize I'm going up against no less an authority than the manager of the Boston Red Sox in saying this, but my experience is that professional athletes are generally ready, no matter how young they are. They've had a lot of seasoning. They've been in the minor leagues for a long time. They have visualized what it's like to be on the big stage in October, and they generally are ready. There may be some specific exceptions to that rule, but I don't think wearing T-shirts that say October ready is going to make a whole lot of difference. Pitching will make a difference if whoever starts each of those games is, in fact, ready to throw a lot of strikes and, not walk guys and throw meatballs at them. Then they'll win.
Okay, so I take your point. Like, these are professionals. They've had a lot of experience. But on the other hand, in terms of postseason experience, I do think there's something to, having younger players who may not have experienced the particular kinds of stresses and pressures that come with postseason play.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But and in some circumstances, you could probably make a stronger case. But Fenway Park is full of people most nights. The Red Sox are on television. They're often on national television. There are a zillion writers in the clubhouse and TV people and radio people every night. Yes, the postseason is different because there's a brighter spotlight, but these guys are not completely unaware of what it means to have a lot of people paying attention to what they're doing.
Okay. All right. I'll grant you that. So let's switch gears and talk about another team that has a lot of people pay attention to what they're doing.
And not happy about it.
No, not happy about it. The Patriots, they face Tampa tomorrow night. But how's the season, in your mind, been going so far? We're in week five here.
Well, the Patriots have demonstrated one of the cruel realities of the game of football, which is it doesn't matter how often and how easily you score if the other team is also scoring often and easily, and if at the end of the game the other team has done that more often than you have. And
yeah,
the Patriots have experienced that a couple of times, and they've been very close to experiencing it on other occasions as well. I don't think anybody saw this coming. I think all the predictions by people much wiser than I am about football were that the Patriots were a very complete team, that Tom Brady was going to be fine, and that the defense was going to be fine, and they were making, as you well know, projections of an undefeated season. I don't think anybody saw the defense being as porous as it has been at the beginning of the season.
Right, and it is a surprise, especially given what you were saying a bit earlier about that truism of sport, that no matter how many points you score, if the other team scores more, they're going to win.
Absolutely.
But Brady's actually having a pretty great season so far.
Absolutely.
At the decrepit, I don't know if I'm going to say that because I am around his age, but age of 40, I mean,
I can't even remember his age. Life begins at 40 for pro quarterbacks, apparently, yeah. Or actually continues at 40 in Tom Brady's case, because he said lots of other great years as well.
Well, it's all that water he drinks
every
day.
Maybe that's it.
The electrolytes. No, but I mean, no interceptions so far, leading the league in passing yards. He's also even been hit quite a lot.
Yeah, if only he could play safety. Play some defense. Return to the age of the two-way football player.
Okay. Well, so let's hope that defensively the Pats get their act together here pretty soon. Let's switch now to the world of World Cup soccer, because there's a big game coming up for Team USA. And I should say, we're talking about the men here, right?
We are this time around, yes.
Okay.
And it is a big game because the U.S. men's team is on the brink of failing to qualify for the World Cup next year in Russia. And I don't know as anybody really quite expected that to be such a tense situation at this point either. We'd reached the point perhaps, or many soccer fans at least, had reached the point where they anticipated that the U.S. would qualify pretty much automatically out of CONCACAF. It's not the world's most competitive group. Boy, they better beat Panama on Friday night.
Mm. Now, if I have my standings right here, they're tied with Honduras with 9 points in the CONCACAF standings now?
Correct.
Okay. And those two teams tied last month, and that was due to when they last faced off, it was due to a last-second goal. I just love the sound of the soccer call, so let's hear it.
That was a Clint Mathis free kick a couple of ago. That one blasted and slapped away by Lopez as it almost found the net. Still loose in front, and it's knocked home by Bobby Wood. Clint Dempsey creates, but it's Wood that finishes and levels in the 85th.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good call. It's not a great
no,
call.
It's nowhere near the great call.
Is always on Univision.
Yeah.
And it goes something like this. Goal! And it doesn't end so quickly because it isn't determined by how much time we have left in the program.
We have 23 seconds left. Do it again. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which you can hear right here on 90.9 WBR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And he's also the station's biggest football fan. Bill, thanks so much.
Goal, Magnet.
This week, we're bringing you excerpts of Modern Love, the podcast. It's a production of WBUR and the New York Times, and I am lucky enough to host it. So today, our excerpt features Cynthia Nixon. She's a Tony winner for her performance in the Broadway drama The Little Foxes, and you probably also know her from Sex and the City. Here she is reading Mary Alice Hostetter's Modern Love essay, Dear Dad, We've Been Gay for a Really Long Time.
The first letter was not mine. Although my brother Charles and I had spent so much time talking about it that I felt some ownership. I was in San Francisco for the Thanksgiving holiday, and we had read and reread the letter he was planning to send to my father, changing a word here and there, rearranging sentences. I suggested he replace gay with homosexual, the word my father was more likely to have heard, usually in the same sentence with abomination, from the pulpit of the Mennonite church he and my mother had attended for decades. I was supportive of my brother, respected his courage, and was flattered that he valued my opinion about something so important, but I didn't fully understand. "You really think he needs to know?" I asked. "How is this going to help him?" "It's not for him," Charles said. "I'm doing this for me. I'm over 60 years old, and he still thinks I'll get married if I find the right woman." "It's not like he's rejected you," I said. "He thinks the sun rises and sets on his doctor sons." "I don't know what he'll do with this, but I need him to know who I am." I told my partner later, "Charles is obsessed with that letter." "Seems like it's important to him for your father to know," she said. "I think our father is doing the best he can," I said. "He never went beyond eighth grade, and he's been a farmer his whole life. His world's pretty narrow. He's 95. Something like this? No telling how he'll take it." "You may as well let it go," she said. The next morning, my brother asked if I wanted to walk with him to the mailbox. The sun was glistening off the buildings on the San Francisco skyline against a brilliant blue sky. We walked to Fillmore, and I watched him drop the letter into the mailbox slot. "There it goes," he said. "No taking it back now," I said. We took the long way home, through Alamo Square Park, the iconic painted ladies lined up in the morning light. "I wonder who'll visit first after he gets the letter," my brother said. "Who'll get to process it with him?" Two of our eight brothers lived near his nursing home in Pennsylvania and checked in on him every week. "I know Abe goes every Wednesday afternoon," I said, "and I think Ike goes on Friday. Abe is a psychiatrist, Ike a retired farmer and Mennonite deacon. There are 12 of us siblings altogether." "Doubt it'll get there by Wednesday," my brother said. My partner and I flew back to Virginia, and the busyness of catching up at work and preparing for the holidays distracted me from wondering when the news would hit the family grapevine. It didn't take long before the reports started trickling in. Each tidbit so remarkable, I began to keep a record so I wouldn't forget. Ike, the farmer brother, was the first one my father showed the letter to. "Did you know this?" my father asked. "Everyone pretty much knows it." "I sure didn't," my father said. "Had no idea." By the following Wednesday, when Abe visited, my father had more questions. "How does this happen?" Abe said, "Seems some people are just born that way." "Are a lot of them born that way?" "About 1 in 10, they estimate." "Well, if it's how people are born, it sure doesn't seem like something that should tear families apart." That proclamation rippled up and down the family grapevine, and it seemed it should echo down the halls of Fairmont Nursing Home, past the nurses' stations, and across the fields to the plain brick Mennonite churches. After my father received and processed my brother's letter, he seemed to spend a good deal of time in his sunny room contemplating this new reality. It was clear he gave some thought to the 1 in 10 theory, and from his vantage point overlooking the nursing home entrance, he counted off visitors, wondering. He talked to visiting family members about unmarried relatives, neighbors. When my younger brother Sanford visited, my father said, "You know, I've been thinking about Eli." Eli was an Amish neighbor. All those years he worked that farm by himself. "I remember when he was younger, he dated girls, but it didn't work out for him. I wonder if that was the story with Eli. Makes me feel bad that he never found someone." And then the question started about me. "It makes me wonder about Mary Alice," my father said. "What about her?" "I guess you should ask her," Sanford said. Of course, my father wasn't going to. It wasn't the sort of thing we would talk about. When Sanford told me about the conversation, I knew it was time to clear things up, to let my father know that I was part of the 1 in 10. I could have dispatched a sibling to deliver my news. I could have shouted it to my hearing-impaired father over the phone or on my next visit. A letter seemed like the most reliable way to communicate. After my brother's courageous letter, I knew mine would be anticlimactic, not only because my brother's came first, but also because I was one of 4 daughters, and in our family, especially from my father's point of view, nothing about being a daughter appeared to have the same import as it would have from a son. So I wrote my letter and sent it. But during my next visit, the subject never came up. My father was as welcoming to my partner and me as he always had been. I considered asking him about the letter, but never did. Had my mother still been alive, I think the conversation would have been outsourced to her. They had lived at the nursing home together for a couple of years before she died at 95. Just a few weeks after they celebrated their 74th anniversary. For years after she died, my father glanced toward her chair when he needed to tell her something, and I'm sure he would have liked to know what she thought of the letters. I can only hope she would have been as understanding as my father was. But I'll never know. The nursing home where my parents lived was run by conservative Mennonites and was consistently recognized for the quality of its care and its cleanliness. Many of the staff members considered their work a religious calling. A steady stream of volunteers cleaned the residents' eyeglasses, shined their shoes, massaged feet, and filled the halls and chapels with music. My father ate his meals in the main dining hall, but insisted on a full-size refrigerator in his room to store his Turkey Hill black cherry ice cream, which my brothers made sure he always had. He kept the bowls and spoons in the refrigerator, along with pretzels and pink mints for the children. He served himself a snack each evening. As one of only a handful of men in the nursing home, my father was much sought after by the widows. He made it clear that he had no intention of remarrying, but he did invite some of them over for a bowl of ice cream now and then. His vision of heaven included reuniting with our mother. Although he was longing for that time, he first wanted to live to be 100, or at the very least, live longer than his older brother, who had died just short of 99. In time, my father's focus on who was or wasn't gay abated. The reality blended into the landscape of carefully tended farms, stretching as far as he could see from his nursing home window. Sometimes I like to imagine him sitting in the sunroom with the three other men in his wing, all of them hard of hearing, him shouting, "And I have two children who are gay. What do you make of that?" My father died 10 years ago, a week short of his 100th birthday. I think it gave him peace knowing all 12 of his children had found someone with whom to share their lives. If he's with my mother in heaven, I hope he has brought her up to date on family news. If he's run into Eli up there, his Amish neighbor, I expect he's told him how sorry he is that he had to work the farm by himself all those years. Recently, many of the Mennonite churches in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, decided to split from Mennonite Church USA, which has chosen to allow openly gay members. The only thing as important as church to my parents was family. I'm glad they didn't live to see this time. Would church or family win? Would my father speak up against his church to tell people, "It's not the sort of thing to tear families apart"? Last May, after 18 years together, my longtime partner and I married. I don't know what my parents would have made of that. But I wish they could have been there.
Cynthia Nixon, reading Mary Alice Hostetter's modern love essay, "Dear Dad, We've Been Gay for a Really Long Time." Now, as part of the Modern Love podcast, we usually follow up with the actors to see why they chose a particular essay to read for us. And so we asked Cynthia why she read this one. And she says that the stoicism of the father in Hostetter's piece really appealed to her.
My mother's family is from Missouri. And I always remember when my mother started seeing a man that she was eventually with for almost 35 years who was Jewish, when she talked to her great aunt, who was like a second mother to her, she was curious to know whether my great aunt would have any negative reaction to that. And my great aunt Edna sort of scrunched up her face and said, "Oh, there's so much more important things than that kind of thing to worry about." And that my great aunt's attitude and her proclamation to me echoed the patriarch's sentiment. And I think there is, running through middle America, that kind of people making up their mind and not making a fuss and having what we would consider a degree of enlightenment, but it's just sort of practical common sense, too. Why would we worry about such a thing?
Thanks again to Cynthia Nixon for reading this modern love essay for us. And if you liked what you heard here, I really hope you did, subscribe to the Modern Love Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your long-form, on-demand listening experiences. Of course, you should also have Radio Boston's podcast there in your queue as well. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.